One of the things I particularly paid attention to in your book was the individual way that you approach the subject of memory. And it has to do with your own personal history, but especially your family history. You are a child and a grandchild of the Holocaust, in a manner of speaking. Is that a correct way of thinking of it? And I know that books have been written and studies have been done about children of Holocaust survivors and the peculiar psychological burdens that puts on their lives, the unusual orientation that they have, a sense of responsibility for just plain being alive under miraculous circumstances, that they, in a certain sense, almost shouldn't be here, and yet they are. They have all that burden placed on them, sometimes by their families, either intentionally or just accidentally by the pure circumstance of it. And I think that often, naturally, would produce a particular orientation towards memory, the responsibilities of memory, but also the burden of memory. That shows up in your book, and you have, for instance, in the poem, "They Called Me," child of the safe place. How do you feel that did, in your case, affect your writing, your life, and your orientation towards this particular book?
Well, I just had a kind of a discomforting experience a couple of weeks ago. My mother's first cousin, Genevieve, who went through the war in France with her, has lately been telling me a lot of stories, mainly because I've had the chance to see her frequently over the last couple of months. And she said, "It's wonderful telling you these stories to pass them on." But then she said, "I never thought that you were interested." That really gave me pause, because certainly that must have been based on a very definite impression she got from me. But I've always been interested in it, but quiet about it, always listening. The poetry now is converting everything that I've heard in piecemeal into some kind of codified myth, a story, to explain the actual stories. But what I rely on are impressions, such as lying in my bed when I was a kid. My bedroom had a wall that was contiguous with our den, with the television in the center, the shrine, and listening to wailing, when my mother would tell the story about how she had to sew the star on her clothing. The story itself is very typical, and you hear it all the time, but it's the wailing. And then getting up in the morning, and she would be there making my breakfast, and nothing else was said, no further explanations. But there would just be these outbursts. And the way my family communicates on my mother's side is with a very abrupt kind of in-your-face statement of things, and also much laughter, incredible laughter. The other thing I heard on the other side of that wall was just crying with laughter at Jack Benny, the comfort of the American comedy and this coming into this life. So that's one way I feel about it. I have just a lot of impressions. For my children now, they want to hear the stories. And I was telling somebody that this Genevieve I was telling you about, her brother was Charles, the oral surgeon. And now that he's gone, one thing I did manage to do in my last job was I worked then for a company that sells these data storage, information storage systems that allow these big institutions to stream video. And there is a thing out in LA that was started by Steven Spielberg around the time that he did Schindler's List, called the Shoah Foundation. And they have done over 50,000 interviews with survivors, digitize them all, and they're all available online. They can all be streamed to you. And they created a database so that they can identify all of the dentists who went to a particular school who emigrated to Brooklyn. You can now start putting people together. Their children can start touching each other, and these stories live on.
Could you go ahead and tell that story about Charles? That's an interesting story about memory as well, a different side of memory.
History is a blind force that cares only about itself. And one of the dangers to a poet who is really interested in history is that you make too much of a differentiation between the forces of politics and personal forces. Because one thing you find out is that the politics of the family, the politics of business, are the same as the politics of government. And even though our politicians lead us into forms of violence that you don't normally see, let's say here at the university, the psychological apparatus is the same, because it's all human. There is, in fact, such a thing as corporate culture, which is determined by the CEO. his personality will radiate down. And it's the same way with the president, it's the same way with your parents and your family, these things. They're forms of control in a way. It's what Kafka objected to, really. All he wanted was privacy more than anything else. Anyway, to go back to my cousin Charles, he came to this country in 1947. He ultimately got his high school equivalency, a diploma, speaks English, goes to Tufts, met his wife at Tufts. She was a poet. He then went to Penn, to dental school, and emerged in his 20s as a dentist. He then felt that he wanted to serve in the U.S. Army to pay back. This is his mentality. He's a very, very positive person. He didn't like people who whined. He didn't like people who complained. It was all, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it. He went to Japan. He was posted in Japan, came back, served the remainder of his service in Washington, which is where he ended up settling down in Bethesda. Well, anyway, he was serving at Walter Reed Hospital. He was just doing his normal rounds. It was November 22, 1963, and the president's body was flown back from Dallas and wheeled into the autopsy room, and he was tapped on the shoulder, and they told him, you're going to participate in this autopsy. There were many papers that he had to sign, and his responsibility was to examine the oral cavity of Jack Kennedy. I was telling Greg last night that his fingers were very pudgy, and I would look at his fingers, I would see him, I would always hug him and kiss him, both cheeks, French style, and then, you know, I would see his fingers, and I always, always looked at his fingers to think about where those fingers had been into the mouth of my beloved president killed on that day. History then becomes really, really personal. And in fact, Kennedy appears a couple of times in my book. It may seem like very distant anecdotal stuff to those who didn't go through it, but to me it was an extremely traumatic thing.
I don't know if you know this book by Susan Gubar called Poetry After Auschwitz. She proceeds from the argument from the very beginning that as Holocaust survivors die off, as the Holocaust fades into history in terms of facts, she's saying that almost the only art form that can contain the subject for the Holocaust anymore is poetry. And I thought of that book when you were reading last night.
The danger of history for a lot of Jews, the Holocaust, is the equivalent of the Passion Play. It's a kind of crucifixion. It can create a victim mentality. It can give you rationalization to do horrible things in defense of your position of being wounded, of having been wounded. So it cuts both ways, and I see it cut both ways. That's why I'm very skeptical about the embrace of reminiscence, memoir, writing that isn't very good literature, that seems to tell that same story over and over again without revealing something that helps us see it as something current, something dangerous. And I don't mean just that we don't want Holocaust to happen again. What I mean is that when we incorporate catastrophe into our lives, it cuts both ways. There's that beautiful poem by Adam Zagajewski, which appeared in the back page of The New Yorker, about praising the mutilated world. And actually, my poem that I read last night about the Coconut Grove is about how when you have catastrophe in your family and it becomes an explanation for the present moment, it can seem very suffocating, especially if you didn't live through that moment and you can distance yourself from it. But at the same time, that poem has lots of details about the fire because there's something attractive and enticing about history. You want to know the details at the same time. That difficulty of the allure and the repulsion of history, that's the difficulty. That's why that poem needs to be written, because that's difficult for me. It's difficult for me to sort that out. I always feel that if I can't incorporate that difficulty into myself, then I'm going to end up writing a poem that is partisan or didactic. And I write poems like that because I have a tendency to, so I'm especially afraid of doing that because I know what will result. It will be not superior work, it'll be flat work, gratuitous
work. In
your poem,
Granite City, you take up that same ambivalence, the quarry that allowed people, the granite, to make monuments and memorials, as well as curbstones and buildings, also made gravestones and churches. And the incident that you recount in that poem of the girl who drowns in rainwater, which ordinarily would be life-giving, here it is in this place, a hole carved out in the name of memory, perhaps, becomes receptacle of death or dangerous place. That's part of your thinking behind that?
Yeah, exactly. You tell your story about being thrown out of town. The mayor of Quincy lives around the corner from my father. And my father's very proud of his son, and he sends the book to the mayor because there are references to Quincy and the surrounding area. Word gets back to my father through my Uncle Al, who also lives two houses away, that the mayor didn't care for that poem too much because Quincy has a reputation about these quarries, which are now being filled in and developers are building golf courses over them. There are a lot of stories about mafia hits being drowned in there and kids being drowned. Every summer, we'd go swimming up there, somebody would drown. Somebody would jump off the rocks and hit their head and drown. The cops were always chasing us away. But it's that same thing, the rejection of not just things that are not standard, but anyone and anything and any statement that may reveal or try to get at what is actually happening, what is actually going on. And that's what Ottavio Paz said. He said the one thing that poets have had in common from the very first poem to wherever they're going is an interest in the hidden side of life, the other side of life, pushing through the envelope to the other side. It occurs in the language, as you write, in the confrontation with the language.
It's interesting, too, to pick up on a poem that precedes Granite City, An Essential Tremor, because in that poem, we often talk about what's the emotional agent that triggers memory, and in that poem, it becomes a physical manifestation of memory. The speaker is literally taken over.
It hadn't occurred to me how much memory has to do with those, although there are obvious reminiscences. I do have this familial tremor or essential tremor. My mother is like this. It's somewhat of an exaggeration. I'm not shaking, but when I'm tired, I tremble, and it's probably not the same kind of trembling that my mother's going through, but it is an apt metaphor, I think, for something caused by something that happened. The story about my grandfather in that poem, they lived near Place de la République in Paris on Boulevard Magenta, and very close to the place, which when I visited there for the first time in 1966, had merry-go-rounds and bumper cars and things like that. When the war started in 1940, there was something called the Phony War. The Germans declared war against France, but then they failed to show up. And ultimately, of course, they did. But when they first came in, the gendarmes came to the apartment, which had already been more or less vacated, and they just took all the furniture up, took everything out. My grandfather was across the street watching them put all this furniture on this truck. And he would tell me the story, but he would just laugh and laugh. He would just say, "That shows you what kind of crummy taste these people have."
In your poems, often you seem to be very interested in locating yourself in that place of ambiguity, or you're ambidextrous in that sense, spiritually ambidextrous, because in the title poem of the book, Incentive of the Maggot, the very thing that perhaps when a person would first come to the book and see that as the title, they would probably imagine that to be a negative poem. It's a poem about death. But the irony of it is it's a poem about salvation. It's a poem about how the maggots actually save the people. So it has that other element in it. The people whose injuries were attacked by the maggots, gangrene actually was ironically cured by the maggots that ate away at that flesh and may have saved their lives. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in that approach. Is that something that you feel keeps you honest or keeps you away from sentimentality?
Well, first of all, I've always been a little wary of that poem because I know how it was made. Actually, when we put the book together, I'll mention too about the titling of the book in a second, but when we put the book together, it seemed like we needed a title poem. In fact, it was recommended to me, write a title poem. It was put to me as, well, that's all you need to do, just write a title poem. And the problem with that is I don't want to write a poem about summation that is too aware of what all the trends are in the book and let me craft something that will do. In fact, I thought, I can't write this. It turned out that there was a period of a year where I wasn't writing after I'd finished the poems of the book, but I was writing these 9-line poems, and I wrote 100 9-line poems, and they were all based on headlines in newspapers, and it was really just to play. And I wrote a 9-line poem called The Incentive of the Maggot, which is essentially the last 9 lines of this poem. It's about going to see the clairvoyant. It's not exactly those lines, but it's that story. My wife and I were having dinner one night, and my oldest daughter, Abby, who's a nurse, came in and said, "Dad, I saw gangrene for the first time," during dinner, and told me the story about this woman who came in septic. Then I went upstairs, and I took those notes. I want to get back to my skepticism about the poem, because I do see it more of a collage than it's something that seemed to be chemically whole in my head. It's one of those that I'm skeptical about. It's also very influenced by Robert Pinsky, his 9/11 poem. Among all the poems that came out about 9/11, I love his the most, because it really looked at 9/11 as a concept, as a word, as something we speak constantly. And Robert also wrote a poem about going to Auschwitz and being unable to emote. And in fact, it's difficult. You feel the distance. You don't want to get hooked by what is expected emotionally. You want to be more careful. That's all built into this poem. And when it comes to the titling, it turned out that I had no talent at titling the book, none at all, because I came up with a bunch of them. The original title of the book was from this poem about going to Cyprus, and the last line is, "A Song Too Strange to Die." And the original title of the manuscript was A Song Too Strange. I worked with Louise Glick on this book, and she said, that is just horrible. I was in Portland, Oregon, and I got a phone call from her after she had been working on the ordering of the poem and so forth and showing me different ways of going about it. And she said, "Why don't you call it The Incentive of the Maggot?" I thought about it for a little while, and it seemed at least as good as anything I'd come up with, you know, originally. That was a title that I wrote, but it wasn't something I thought would work as the title of the book. And actually, some people like it, and some people really don't like it. The people at Houghton Mifflin really didn't like it. You know, I was told, well, we don't want the people inside Houghton Mifflin calling this book The Maggot. Basically, I would say the title has worked.